You've seen the movie, you've read the book, you've got the t-shirt. Now experience it for yourself. Crazy Eddie's Christmas in August TV and video blowout blitz. Crazy Eddie's going to save you a blizzard of bucks on TVs, VCRs, anything and everything in TV and video. Remember, we are not undersold. We will not be undersold. We cannot be undersold. And we mean it. It's Crazy Eddie's Christmas in August TV and video blowout blitz. See Crazy Eddie now. His prices are insane.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Jacob Goldstein.
And I'm David Kestenbaum. Today is Tuesday, July 5th, and that was radio DJ Jerry Carroll you heard at the top in the 1980s ad for Crazy Eddie's. On the show today, we are going to teach you how to launder money, how to cheat on your taxes, and how to deceive shareholders. But first, of course, the Planet Money Indicator.
Today's Planet Money Indicator is 2. The economic recovery in the U.S. is now 2 years old.
Should we sing happy birthday?
Well, it's not really that happy, and I actually missed it a little bit. The recovery started back in June of 2009, so if you want to be technical, its second birthday was last month.
I can understand why you missed it, though, because a recovery doesn't really mean you're booming ahead. It just means that we passed the bottom, or they think we passed the bottom, right? And you're slowly climbing.
And in the case of this recovery, really slowly climbing. You know, the economy, it has been adding jobs over the past 2 years, but barely, not even fast enough to keep up with population growth. And GDP, yeah, GDP is rising, but it's rising about half as fast as it has been in previous economic recoveries. And, you know, like we've talked about before, there is still this great big overhang of debt, especially mortgage debt that the country has to deal with. And that debt burden, I think, as much as anything, is this weight that's going to keep pressing down on the recovery really for the foreseeable future.
I'm going to celebrate the fifth birthday.
The fifth birthday, maybe we'll really be fired up about the recovery.
Now it is time to go inside the mind of a financial criminal. So Jacob, did you hear about Crazy Eddie's when you were growing up?
Yeah, I think so. I grew up on the West Coast, but I remember like Crazy Eddie was the guy who would like go on the radio and scream about his deals or something.
Right, right. That thing you heard at the top. So the guy in those ads is actually radio announcer Jerry Carroll. And we should say, since we're talking about crimes here, that Jerry Carroll had no part in the illegal activities of Crazy Eddie's, which were many. He was just the public face of the company. Anyway, Crazy Eddie's was the name of this chain of electronics stores in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut. And it turns out the people running Crazy Eddie's were doing a lot of really crazy illegal things. The U.S. attorney at the time, Michael Chertoff, called Eddie Antar of Crazy Eddie's the Darth Vader of capitalism. So Adam Davidson and I here talked to a key member of Crazy Eddie's operation, Sam Antar, who cooked the books for the entire family. And I got to say, he seemed proud of his bit as a bad guy.
Convicted felon, former criminal chief financial officer of Crazy Eddie's.
It was a really great interview. So Antar says Crazy Eddie's was crooked from the very, very start. They were just crooked on a smaller scale. And like a lot of small businesses, he says they didn't always pay their sales tax.
From 1969 to 1980, our primary fraud was skimming and stealing sales tax. I mean, sales taxes is a license to steal. You collect the money for the New York State Sales Tax Department, you skim off you not only skim off the profits, but you also skim off that 8% sales tax, which is more than most of the operating income of most companies. In fact, there's a joke around the New York State Sales Tax Department. If you eliminated the sales taxes, half the mom and pops in New York would be out of business.
It turns out it's really, really simple to hide how much money you make from the government. You just don't deposit the money in the bank. You keep a good chunk of your profits, and then the government has no way of knowing. And so they did this for a while, and it worked really, really well. But eventually, they had a problem.
We had the money in the mattresses, the basements, and the ceiling, all over. I mean, we had money everywhere. There was millions of dollars, you know. Whatever. Eventually, you want to do something with the money because cash doesn't earn interest. And in those days, interest rates were relatively high.
So this is where they go from skimming taxes to actually full-on, like, international fraud and money laundering. Sam says they found this crooked guy at Bank Leumi, the Israeli bank. And basically what they do is Sam's cousins would fill huge briefcases with cash. He said he's actually, Sam Antar is an expert. You can show him any size bag and he could tell you exactly how much money could fit in that bag. And they would deposit the money in Bank Leumi in Tel Aviv. And then, and David, I gotta admit, I don't fully understand all the details, although it's very, very confusing. But somehow they would use the money at the branch in Israel to get the Bank Leumi branch in New York to lend the money at favorable rates, and there was some tax thing involved. Did you understand it, David?
No, but and it made me realize it was actually pretty hard to be a money launderer.
It's very complicated. But then they moved in a different direction that is clear and big and easy to understand. Their big, big scam, which is a stock scam. And to understand this, there's just two things you need to understand. One is, you know, these are, as Sam Antar described it, these are a bunch of guys who lived in Brooklyn, not the heights of education. And basically, Crazy Eddie told his nephew Sam, you've got to get educated. We need someone in this family who really understands finance so that we can be more ambitious in our scams. So he sent Sam Antar to college. And then what Sam came up with was the idea that they would take the company public and they would artificially increase the market value of the company by stopping skimming the taxes. Right, David?
So it was this great idea. They had all this sales off the books. They were going to slowly bring it back on the books so it would look like increased profits. Hey, more business every year.
Even though they're making the same amount of money, they're just officially making more and more and more.
At the time I was going to college, I was training to be a CPA. I had more financial sophistication. I understood more about how the markets work from just reading the Wall Street Journal from when I was 12 years old. Now it's around 1979, 1980. Actually, at the time I graduated college around 1980, 1981, and I had much more financial sophistication. I said, this is the way the markets work.
So they did you sit growth. Down your uncles and give them a presentation?
Yes, my cousins, yeah. We sat at the kitchen table, 2146 East 3rd Street in Brooklyn at his old house.
Okay, so you did go public?
Yeah, we go public in 1984. Success. Now, there's no incentive to skim. There's no incentive to steal the sales tax.
Because you guys are majority shareholders.
Right. We own all of the stock. The Antar family owns all of the stock. And when you sell the stock based upon inflated profits as opposed to deflated profits from skimming, you make even more money and you only pay capital gains.
And are you guys all selling stock all the time?
Yeah, the Antars, well, I was not the immediate family. I didn't have the same amount of stock that they did. So, but they sold about $100 million worth of stock for about over 3 years, $100 million.
And how much would that really be worth if there was proper valuation?
Well, if we were crooks from day one, it was never worth anything. You can't take a crooked company public. So so I will go from ground zero. This company was never worth anything.
Can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
So just to understand this strategy, this is your brilliant business strategy, which is we've been hiding all these profits. We're now going to start to bring them on the books, so it's going to look like our profits are going up and up and up, and then we're going to go public. And because the profits in the past years have been going up and up and up, people are going to overvalue the stock.
Right, because they see the growth curve. Wall Street is based upon expectation. It's not based upon today's earnings. It's based upon the expectations of earnings 1, 2, 3, 4 years down the road. You can have two companies with the same profits, same exact income statement, same exact balance sheet, twins split at the egg. But one company will be valued more depending upon its growth potential.
Right. So that is your plan. You're going to go public based on this false history of increasing sales. The price of the stock will be much higher than it ought to be. And you're going to own a bunch of the stock because you own the company. And you're going to start to sell that at more than it's worth.
Yes. It pays to go legit so you can commit your next crime.
So we should be aware of any company that's making profits.
You should be aware of any company that doesn't have a hiccup. You should be aware because the road to success has its bumps. The road to success is usually 2 steps forward, 1 step back, 3 steps forward, 4 steps back, 5 steps forward. When you see a smooth road to success, chances are there's something wrong.
Did you think about that? Did you think, oh, we ought to have a down year?
No, because we criminals don't think in those terms. We have this heightened sense of accomplishment, of confidence. We don't think in those terms.
All right, so you only had, 4 or 5 years of this triumph of this hundreds of millions of dollars?
Yeah, but I didn't tell you about the next scam, which was
please.
Now, all right, so we're pumping up our profits. 1986 comes along. We're in our last quarter. Wall Street expects a 5% revenue increase in something called same-store sales. That's sales in stores that are open during 2 similar accounting periods, factoring out new store openings. In other words, how much of base sales store growth do you have? And we were running 5% going into the end of February, okay, which is our fiscal year ended on March 2nd, 1986. And Wall Street expected 10%. And Eddie and his father wanted to sell a lot of stock. And they felt that if there was a disappointment in our revenue figure, the stock would go down, they'd get less value. Herein is called the Panama pump. We take the money from Israel, we wire it to Bank Leumi, Panama, two separate bank secrecy jurisdictions to create a layer. Now, how do you bring the money into the United States and not run afoul of the currency laws? If you brought in cash in the United States, more than $10,000, you had to fill out a squeal form, you know, that I brought in cash. Now, criminals have no problem lying on it, but you always try to reduce your risks if you can, just like in your business. Okay, if you bring in checks into the United States, that's a negotiable instrument. You can't bring it because that too, you have to fill out the squeal form. But what we do is we bring it in the form of bank drafts. A check says pay to the order of. The words to the order of makes a check negotiable and subject to various restrictions and subject to various disclosures. But a bank draft says pay to. A check can be negotiated to a third party, endorse the back of it, etc. A bank draft cannot. So we legally bring in the money that we had skimmed overseas to pump up our sales and our profits. In other words, we take previous money that we stole from the company and we give a little bit back so we can sell stock at hyped up prices and make it back that way.
And you brought this new money in, deposited in your account, and said, wow, we made a lot of money.
Yeah, because you know what it is? I'll tell you what the problem with audits is. They saw that the money was in the bank and they said, okay, the money's in the bank, the revenues are there. But they didn't look to see how the revenues got there. Later on, an act was passed called the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, wonderful act, maybe not strong enough, which reformed corporate governance and made the auditors more accountable. The auditors were forced to look at internal controls more seriously. You see, this case is here. In substance, the money is there, so how did it get there? It had to be a sale. These guys wouldn't have put the money in. But internal control evaluation means how did the money get there? The auditors never looked to see how the money got there.
All right. How did this all end?
Well, it all ended. It's got to go back. I got to go back to day one to tell you how it all ended. Originally, Crazy A's was ERS Electronics, Eddie, Ronnie, and Sam. Ronnie was the cousin. Well, Ronnie doesn't have the staying power, and Eddie buys out Ronnie Gindy, and Eddie owns two-thirds of Crazy Eddie's, which becomes from Sights and Sounds to Crazy Eddie's, and his father owns one-third. But his father owned a lot of other businesses, and his father was the patriarch of the Antar family. And the father didn't mind that Eddie owned two-thirds of the small, little, dinky, one-store retail operation because he had other things. But as Crazy Eddie's grows, Eddie's stature rises, and he becomes the de facto head of the Antar family. He was a handsome guy, very, very, you know, he was a great speaker, great leader. And his father and his brothers grow jealous of Eddie's success.
So, David, this is when it just, the family drama, it was actually, I found it truly painful to hear. Antar agreed. It is a despicable family in which father and son, brother and brother, cousin and cousin, they're just backstabbing each other, lying to each other, cheating each other. But for most of the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, everyone's making tons of money. And so every fight is, they reach peace pretty quickly because they know that they can all make more money together than if they were all split apart. But then by about 1987, it all falls apart because by then the family had sold pretty much all of its stock and they didn't have a financial incentive to stick together. And they're all starting to think like, God, what if we go to jail? And so they just all turn on each other.
This time, instead of patching things over, Eddie cleans house. He cleans out his father and his brothers and their allies. He throws them out of the company. And what do? They get even. They're worried that the company may be taken over because in those days there was a lot of takeovers and the company, people were thinking the company was undervalued and the family infighting was bringing the company down. Nobody knew that on the outside there was a fraud. They were worried that a fraud would be uncovered eventually if the company got taken over and that they would be blamed by Eddie and I. So they send two witnesses to the United States Attorney's Office as a front and they talk about the frauds minus their side of the family. And they don't talk about any of the skimming from before we were a public company because that would implicate implicate both sides. So these two witnesses lie to the federal government for 2 years after our fraud is uncovered when we lose control
these
of the
company. These two witnesses being your uncles?
No, no. Two witnesses, two non-family witnesses that were associated with that side of the family.
I see. So what happens? Is there a day, a pivotal day where suddenly...
Yeah, 1989. Eddie and I find out we've been set up, and Eddie is getting ready to leave to go to Israel. Because the criminals don't play by the rules, but the government has to. They have to provide documents in discovery. Civil litigants have to whatever. And we get their evidence. Of course, we destroy ours. We never give out anything. We don't give ice in the winter as crooks. But anyway, we find out that we've been set up. Eddie separates myself from me. He's getting ready to bolt. And here I am. One side of the family rats me and Eddie out. Then my mentor, I mean, Eddie was 10 years older than me when I started working at Crazy Eyes when I was 14. My mentor, the guy that I worship, he's bolting on me. So what do? I cooperated with the feds in 1989. At first, they thought that their witnesses were telling the truth, and I was lying. Eventually, the government realizes that their two initial witnesses gave them a Trojan horse. They indict one. The other one, I don't know what happened to, but they don't use those two witnesses again, and I become the government's main witness in the Crazy Eddie investigation.
Did you do any time?
No, I got 6 months house arrest, 1,200 hours community service, $10,000 in fines. I had to pay the SEC $20,000. For selling stock at inflated prices. Actually, I lost money, ultimately lost money on my Crazy Eddie stock, but I should have lost more money because it was worth less than what I sold it for. And the victims, because I cooperated them and I showed them where all the bodies were buried, they gave me a complete civil walk. I walked away from Crazy Eddie's with basically unscathed.
Who did go to jail?
Eddie Antar went to jail for 7 years. His brother Mitchell went to jail for 2 years. His brother Alan was acquitted in the criminal case, but the real story is in the civil case brought by the SEC and the civil plaintiffs. For 5 more years after the criminal trial in 1993, the SEC and the civil plaintiffs, the class action lawyers, pursued the Antar family money at all ends of the earth. They were able to recover more money than the Antars actually made on the securities fraud because of the previous skimming.
How's the Antar family? Do you all get together for Passover?
No. They hate me.
They hate you?
No,
because you ratted out?
Yeah, I ratted them out, yeah.
What did you learn?
What did I learn? I learned that it's easier to talk about crime, to teach people about crime, than it is to commit crime. It's more fun being on the other side than committing it and taking all the risk. But the fascination with crime still remains the same. Crime really doesn't pay. In the end, you're going to get caught.
But watching your demeanor, you enjoy talking about this.
It's easier to talk about it and to teach others about, because I trained the Secret Service. I've trained the FBI, the Securities and Exchange Commission, basically every three-letter agency that you know of and some that you'll never hear of in the United States government, the Internal Revenue Service Criminal Division. I've gone to college and university. I teach about white-collar crime. But it's easier to teach people about the effects and about the criminality involved in white-collar crime than it is to actually commit the crime. There's no risk this way.
And what you do is basically what you did for us?
This is generally how I start out when we talk about the Crazy Eddie fraud, but I do much, much more detail how you money launder, what the steps are that auditors should have taken but didn't take. But the most important detail that people have to understand that white-collar crime is a brutal crime. It's in many cases more brutal than violent crime because our crimes inflict a collective harm on society. The actions of one or a few can cause billions of damages. Look at the Bernie Madoff case. And people kind of give us a pass. Like you're smiling now, you two guys are in the studio with me. If I were a serial killer and telling you, how I chopped up dead bodies, we wouldn't be laughing about my techniques, would you? Whatever. But we kind of give the white-collar criminal a pass. And there's no reason for it. If I didn't get caught, I'd still be the criminal CFO of Crazy Eddie today.
I was actually going to ask you, do you feel bad about what you did?
It's irrelevant what I feel.
Here's the educational point.
If I told you I felt bad, does it do anything? If I told you I felt bad, should you believe it? Judge people, as a crook that used words to defraud people, right? To misinform people, right? To lie to people. Why should you believe me now if I tell you I feel sorry for my crimes?
Well, just tell me. Do you? I'll decide whether I want to believe you or not.
Well, you have to judge me for my actions. I did 11 years of free work for the United States government, for top educational institutions, whatever. Judge me by my actions, not by my words.
Why don't you say it, though?
Because it is against the criminal. It's against the former criminal vocabulary, as I said. All right, okay. I feel sorry for my crimes. Now, do you believe me? I don't want to play a violin of redemption. It doesn't do anything. Apologies are meaningless. People, I saw Bernie Madoff was going up to the, I was on Fox Business Channel and I was commenting as Bernie Madoff was making his apology. I said, the only reason, when I made my apology, I really felt, I was only felt bad that I got caught. What's the relevance of an apology? How does Bernie Madoff or any criminal's apology help any victim?
I'm not asking you to apologize. I'm just curious, in your head, how you feel.
I feel bad about it. Yes, I do. I do feel guilty about it.
As always, we'd love to hear what you thought of today's show. Please send us email. We're planetmoney@npr.org.
You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter and on the blog at npr.org/money. I'm Jacob Goldstein.
And I'm David Kestenbaum. Thank you for listening.